Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From Detroit today, some good news and some not so good news. Also on the broadcast, YouTube videos and the business of holiday foods. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 3rd of December. And we're going to get going today with some news from the Motor City, Detroit, Michigan, of course. Item number one, a federal judge ruled this morning that the city is indeed eligible to file for bankruptcy protection and in the process potentially unload billions of dollars of debt, including pension liabilities. Appeals paperwork, it is safe to assume, is already being drawn up on that ruling. Item number two, how about those car makers? Huh? U.S. automakers are reporting their best sales figures in 6.5 years. And with an eye toward the November unemployment report due out Friday, this would seem to be a hopeful sign. A big increase in auto sales leading to a big increase in auto jobs. No? No. Kinda. Marketplace's David Gura explains.
Americans were buying trucks, Rams, Sierras, Silverados, and F-150s, pickups. But last month's pickup in pickup sales, sorry about that, probably won't lead to more jobs making trucks.
You don't want to have this layoff, recall situation.
Art Schwartz used to be GM's director of labor relations. Now he's an economic consultant.
You want to get a more regular kind of employment level and production level.
Rather than hiring more workers or opening new factories, manufacturers are running existing plants at full capacity. Some are open 6 days a week, three shifts a day.
They're less likely to bring on people unless they think this is going to be a permanent increase. And even then, it's going to be a slow go.
That's because of lingering uncertainty. But all those pickups driven off of dealers' lots, that's a good sign for the labor market writ large. Mike Jackson works for IHS Automotive.
You know, the majority of buyers in the space use a pickup as a tool.
They haul rebar and 2x4s. They drive those trucks to work.
You know, contractors of every sort who've delayed purchases in the past are now seeing very, very definitive results, very strong demand, and so they feel confident enough they can make a big-ticket purchase.
Truck sales also signal growth in the energy sector. Jackson says if you do hydraulic fracturing or fracking, you probably own a truck.
The very nature of the process itself requires a significant number of pickups to be in the field.
And while a spike in truck sales may not necessarily result in more jobs making those trucks, it's good news for the auto sector for one very important reason. David Cole is the chairman of Auto Harvest.
Companies make a lot of money on trucks.
The profit margins on pickups are huge, at times close to $10,000. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Vice President Biden is one day into what's going to turn out to be a really long week in Asia. Little did he know when he planned this trip, the vice president, that he'd be walking into the middle of a spat between the world's second and third biggest economies, China and Japan in that order, over China's newly declared air defense identification zone. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz is in Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So the vice president has set himself down amidst quite a squabble there, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's like you're about to have dinner with that neighbor who keeps eyeing the property lines between his and everybody else's house, except in this case, that testy neighbor happens to be the world's second largest economy. These are not going to be easy meetings for Vice President Biden. The Chinese feel strongly about their claims to this area in the zone, especially the islands China calls the Diaoyu and which Japan calls the Senkaku. And the announcement of this new air defense zone is the latest sticking point in what is a very tense relationship between China and Japan.
And it's been tense for a little while now. So the question is, why did China pick now to do this, knowing that Biden was coming, that the Japanese, the number three economy in the world, wouldn't like it? What gives?
Right. You know, it is the first year of President Xi Jinping's presidency, and part of his agenda has been pushing what he calls the Chinese dream. And part of that dream is to be seen and treated by the international community as a global power. You know, ever since the 1960s, Japan has had a similar air defense zone in the East China Sea. And one point that the Chinese made when they announced their zone was that its zone would be as close to Japan's shores as Japan's zone is to China's. So they're saying, look, if the world's third largest economy can have an air defense zone that comes right up to our territory, we can too.
What's at stake for us in this? I mean, it's not just Japan and China that are involved here. We've got trade interests in the region as well.
Right. You know, on a country-by-country basis, China is Japan's biggest trading partner, and Japan is China's second biggest, second to the United States. So, you know, that's hundreds of billions of dollars in trade between the three countries. You know, the U.S. is bound by treaty obligations to help defend Japan in the event of a conflict. So if China should threaten aircraft that don't identify themselves in this zone, and two Japanese airlines have so far refused to do so, it could definitely impact the global economy. I talked to Taylor Fravel about this today. He's an expert on Japan-China relations at MIT, and here's what he told me.
It could impact economic relations if, for whatever reason, a civil aircraft was unable to identify itself and China took measures that were viewed as hostile against that aircraft, including threatening that aircraft in any way. It's unlikely to happen, but the possibility exists, and the creation of the zone has increased the possibility of some kind of incident occurring.
When you get out and about, Rob, and talk to people, is this at all a factor on the streets, or is it no big deal?
I think it is. You know, as you know, Kai, many Chinese, especially older Chinese, don't have warm and fuzzy feelings about Japan. There's a violent history of brutal Japanese occupation of China in World War II, and whenever the state media decides to ramp up coverage of the dispute over these islands, it reminds many Chinese about this tumultuous history, and it becomes an issue for many of China's sovereignty. So with this backdrop, you're not going to have too many Chinese disagreeing with this air defense zone. You know, from my conversations with people here, I think they see it as other developed countries have air defense zones. Why does everyone complain when we want one? So this will be the attitude among Chinese leaders, too, when Vice President Biden visits Beijing tomorrow.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for us. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks, Guy.
Help me out here for a second. What's that saying? Three of anything is a trend, right? Third down day in a row on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. About a third of all the students in college today in this country are the first in their families to go beyond high school. And that can make the choice of where to go all the more difficult. It's a question of distance and cost, whether they'll graduate, and even how much they'll earn, assuming they do graduate. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR a big chunk of top-notch high school students don't even consider applying to a top college simply because nobody has ever told them that they should. Here's Amy.
When George Alvarez was in high school and starting to apply to colleges, a top university like Johns Hopkins wasn't even on his radar.
I actually never heard about Johns Hopkins until my senior year when my history teacher told me to apply there.
George grew up on Long Island, the son of a housekeeper and a retired mechanic. He knew he wanted to be a doctor and was looking at a low-cost program nearby where he could earn a bachelor's degree and an MD in 7 years.
And my history teacher was like, you could go there. Or you can go to Hopkins and experience college life and then apply to medical school.
So he applied to both schools and got into both. Hopkins, with its sticker price of more than $50,000 a year, turned out to be cheaper. With grants and scholarships, just $5,000 a year. So he and his parents, immigrants from El Salvador, whose own schooling stopped at sixth grade, headed for Baltimore to visit. It was George's first time out of New York.
The first thing I noticed is there were no metal detectors in the entrance as they were in my high school.
That was 4 years ago. George is a senior now. I meet him at the university's plush new undergraduate teaching labs, where students lounge on rocking chairs and sip lattes in a glass atrium. Looking back, George says that first visit almost kept him away.
I was intimidated, especially once I was here, once I was immersed with my other classmates who I felt were better than me.
George had been a straight-A student at Uniondale High School. Even so, his guidance counselor advised him to pick the local program. It was competitive, but at a less selective school. She said Hopkins wouldn't be a good fit.
You're going to be alone. You're going to the dorm situation. The financial aid is only for a year. There were many reasons why I should not come to the school.
George thinks now that counselor was probably trying to protect him.
It's not at all unusual to have guidance counselors advise low-income students to go to the kinds of colleges where other low-income students go instead of going to the sort of colleges for which they are best prepared.
That's Caroline Hoxbee, an economist at Stanford University. Her research on so-called undermatched students has shaken up the college admissions world this year. Hoxbee says most low-income, high-achieving seniors don't even apply to the Harvards and McAllisters and UCLAs of the world, even though they tend to fare much better at places like those.
They're more likely to get good academic advice, to live in a housing situation where the other students are studying and are interested in staying in college. They're more likely to be in a cohort of students where everyone believes that they're going to complete on time.
And they're more likely to land better jobs with higher pay. Hoxbee says if you're qualified to go to a top college and don't,
our minimum estimate is that you're giving up $500,000 over your lifetime in net present dollars. And that's our minimum estimate.
Hoxbee says sometimes all it takes is the right information. She's been working with the College Board to send out customized packets to top low-income students, comparing financial aid and graduation rates at various colleges. Johns Hopkins is part of the effort. David Phillips is vice provost for admissions and financial aid. He says George's story of finding Hopkins is common.
That's almost an accident, right? A happy accident that he ran into the right teacher to steer him in the right direction. That too often is the case. And that's the great thing, one, about the research that's helping reach out to students in more systematic ways. And schools need to do that.
But of course, getting students to campus is just the beginning. For George, it was a rocky start. On his third chemistry exam, he got a 10 out of 76. That first year, he thought about quitting every night.
I thought this was too hard. I thought I'd be a happier person being back home in New York and not having to adjust to a completely different life.
His adjustment came thanks to another happy accident. Eventually, he found his way to the Office of Multicultural Affairs, where he met lots of other students from backgrounds like his. He's now a leader there.
Hi, everyone.
Come to this side. Come to this side.
Guys, don't be shy.
Come to this side.
On a recent night, George advised freshmen and sophomores at an event for underrepresented students thinking about medical careers.
I wish someone mentored me. I wish people could tell me you're going to be fine, that everyone who's told you that you can't make it is wrong, because you've made it already.
George is set to graduate in the spring with a degree in biophysics. He plans to take a year off and apply to med school. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's lots more from Amy's series First in the Family at marketplace.org. Coming up, I'll tell you what, nothing says Christmas like white chocolate peppermint Pringles.
Someone described it unflatteringly as a little bit like having toothpaste on the chips.
Yeah, buddy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials down again, lost 0.5%. Today, the blue chips did 94 points, closed at 15,914. The NASDAQ erased 0.2%, 8 points, finished at 4,037. The S&P 500 down 0.3%. That is 5.1795, the number at the bell. As we told you, November was a solid month for automakers, but some stocks were down on fears that coming months might not be quite so good. GM reversed 2.5% today. Ford traded down nearly 3%. Tesla, though, juiced up more than 16% today after Morgan Stanley made it a, quote, top pick. Overseas, Britain's FTSE was off nearly 1%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei was up 0.6%, closing at a six-year high. Bond prices rose barely. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. FBI agents are scheduled to discuss national security issues at the National Press Club. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for October. It also releases new home sales for September and October. And in New York City, a big holiday symbol gets plugged in with the Christmas tree lighting at Rockefeller Center. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Dow Chemical has been around since the 1890s. It's one of the great American industrial icons. And after more than 100 years, the biggest chemical maker in the country is considering dropping the word chemical from its name. It's not, at least on the face of it, a marketing ploy or a cheap rebranding scheme. Dow is literally selling off its commodity chemicals business. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains why Dow is abandoning the products that made it a household name.
In the early years of Dow, the company made its money selling two products, bleach and potassium bromide, an over-the-counter sedative. And with both products, foreign companies tried to undercut Dow's sales. When German bromide producers flooded the U.S. with cheap bromide, Dow bought it and then sold it back to the competitors of those same German companies. It was a brilliant strategy that kept Dow alive and taught it a valuable lesson. Diversify.
Have you tried Saran Wrap? It really is amazing.
Get Saran Wrap at your grocer's. Saran Wrap is a product of the Dow Chemical Company.
In 1953, Dow created a consumer products division that would give birth to a string of wildly popular products like Saran Wrap, the Ziploc bag, and a whole range of plastics that is sold to manufacturers.
And suddenly the world was very alive to the possibility of replacing natural materials with synthetically produced materials, and plastics was a big part of that.
Ashish Arora wrote a paper on the history of the chemical industry. He says that because Dow could produce chemicals cheaply, it had an advantage over competitors. But as technology spread, foreign companies were able to produce those chemicals for much less.
The significant advantage that companies like Dow had in producing those chemicals diminishes to the point where it's deemed no longer advantageous for the company to be in those businesses.
Dow plans to exit the chlorine business altogether, the foundation of its original product. Instead, Dow wants to develop products with higher profit margins, like agricultural seeds, electronics, and packaging made from, you guessed it, plastics.
As far as standard plastics, Dow is actually making major investments in those in the U.S. Gulf Coast because of all the shale gas development that's going on.
Frank Esposito is a senior reporter at Plastics News. He says 5 years ago, no one thought companies would be investing in plastic manufacturing here in the U.S. But with the abundance of shale gas, there's an unexpected source of raw materials needed to make plastics. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
If you're used to procrastinating with a couple of good YouTube videos, you might have noticed something going on, a shift in the kinds of videos that are getting a lot of play. Cats banging away at the piano, apparently, are no longer the juggernaut of online entertainment. Nowadays, a whole lot of people are watching videos about dark matter or the periodic table. The top science channels on YouTube can make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, meaning that the people running those sites could actually quit their day jobs. Sruthi Penamaneni has the story.
For the past 7 years, Joe Hansen has been tied to the lab bench, inching towards his PhD in biology. But he was one of those guys who just couldn't keep his geeky enthusiasms to himself.
I was always that guy at parties who wanted to tell you about this cool article he read. And instead of having people walk away, I decided I would start putting this online.
After a couple of years writing a popular science blog, Hansen got a call last November from PBS Digital Studios. They asked if he wanted to host his own science show on YouTube.
I didn't see myself at the bench working with my petri dishes and stuff anymore. And as soon as I was crowned with my doctorate, full speed ahead into teaching on YouTube.
Hi, welcome to It's Okay to Be Smart. I'm Joe Hansen.
This is a show about science, but it's about so much more.
In the last year, YouTube has become the place to watch really smart people with advanced degrees.
It's come to our attention here at Zyzha that some people think that narwhals are not real.
Sweet. So this is kind of frozen, congealed blood in here. See it moving around in the veins.
When I was in second grade, Mrs. McGonagall told us that the ancient dinosaurs died out because they had small brains.
That last one was, you guessed it, Bill Nye the Science Guy. But how did he and all these other pop scientists get here on YouTube? Kevin Alaka is the head of culture and trends at YouTube.
There have been a couple of big science moments in the last year or two. The Mars rover landing was a huge deal. Stratos, the Red Bull jump from space, the Russian meteor.
At the same time, Alaka says within the company, they were seeing the rise of these science channels that were putting out fun, compelling videos.
We've all sort of come to understand like, oh, we're really interested in this kind of stuff, and people are getting really good at feeding it to us.
Okay, so YouTube's gotten the attention of brainy people. But the question is, can these online science teachers actually make a living? Henry Reich runs Minute Physics, one of the most popular science shows on YouTube.
This wouldn't be a YouTube channel without a cat video. So without further ado, we present Schrodinger's cat.
Reich uses stick figure drawings to explain physics. I asked him what it costs to make his videos.
My budget is basically zero once I have the equipment. It costs me the expense of buying printer paper and Crayola markers.
Minute Physics videos average 1 million views every week. Reich can't disclose how much ad money he earns. In general, though, 1 million views on YouTube could average $1,000 to $2,000. Add to that corporate sponsorships, which can be up to $20,000 a video, and the big science channels are doing pretty well for themselves. But does that mean any science enthusiast could actually pull this off?
You know, getting 1 million views is still really hard, and the bigger YouTube gets, the harder it is to discover things.
Again, this is Joe Hansen, the PhD-turned-YouTube host. He says, yeah, it's getting harder, but that doesn't seem to keep the science lovers from trying.
My two most common emails now are, hey, should I get a PhD? And hey, how can I do what you do?
Hansen gets these questions so often, he's working on a YouTube video that'll share his advice. In a most scientific manner, of course. In New York, I'm Shruti Pinnamaneni for Marketplace.
Just because there aren't enough gimmicky holiday things this time of year, retailers trying every which way to get us to buy more, we turn now to food with a little bit of holiday cheer, I suppose you might say. Vanessa Wong writes about the food business at Bloomberg Business Week. Vanessa, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai. Great to be on again. Thanks for having me.
I will tell you that I find this idea of festive flavoring somewhat problematical.
Why is that?
I can't find it actually right here in the studio, but there's a Pringles flavoring for the holidays that just it boggled my mind. Pecan pie Pringles was one of them, and there was another one, right?
Yeah, so there are pecan pie Pringles and cinnamon and sugar Pringles.
Okay, these are potato chips, you guys. Come on.
Right. It's not the first time. Pringles last year did pumpkin pie spice and white chocolate peppermint Pringles. Someone described it unflatteringly as a little bit like having toothpaste on the chip.
Oh. So. people actually must buy these things, right? I mean, I know I'm making light of it, and we are, I suppose, but people do buy these things and eat them.
Oh, absolutely. It totally works. I mean, the fourth quarter from October to December is, you know, typically the busiest period for supermarkets and grocery
stores. Oh, is that right?
Stores.
Not just regular retailers, but groceries too?
Grocery stores as well. The period, you know, around Thanksgiving and Christmas is the biggest time for seasonal in and out items. And whether or not they succeed, a lot of them do, depends on either, you know, what flavors available that year, but also how the retailer decides to display them. Depending on what your consumer is, there are certain ways to help move items off the shelves a little bit faster. This is something that happens every year, and companies you know, such as Kellogg, which does Pringles, and Kraft, don't mess around. So it's definitely something that makes their customers loyal and happy.
It's worth noting, for all my scorn of these flavored items, that Starbucks and pumpkin spiced latte has sold 200 million of those drinks in the past 10 years.
Oh, yeah. It's like a beverage with a cult following. And people really look forward to the launch of pumpkin spice latte every fall. But there are kind of more winter-flavored lattes at Starbucks. They have a peppermint mocha, caramel brulee, yeah, gingerbread, and even an eggnog latte.
Or one could just have a cup of coffee.
Right, yeah, exactly. You'll save yourself a few calories that way.
What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite thing?
I would probably go with some of the coffee-flavored holiday offerings.
Really? Like holiday-themed like, Coffee Mate powdered whatevers?
Right, yeah.
Oh, man.
It's those refrigerated creamers that you'll find, you know, like dark chocolate fudge this year and spiced latte. And in past years, they've done pumpkin spice and peppermint, which they say were their best sellers.
All right, you know what the good part of all this is?
What's that?
The holidays are going to be over soon. That's what the good part of all this is.
Right.
All right. That's it. Vanessa Wong of Bloomberg Business Week. Thank you.
Thank you. Happy eating.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, a sequel of sorts to our YouTube Science Videos story, just to completely dispel any notion you might have had that the internet is a force for good. BuzzFeed talked to the folks at YouTube about what are called haul videos, H-A-U-L videos, shoppers showing off what they've bought. Anyway, there are 800,000 haul videos on YouTube at the moment, which combined have more views than Gangnam Style, that outrageously viral South Korean music video from a year or two ago. That, in turn, just passed 1.8 billion views. So think about what we're doing on YouTube. We're watching people show off what they bought. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this, Tuesday it is. Today, the Dow down again, lost 0.5%, 94 points. The NASDAQ raised 0.2%, 8 points. The S&P 500 down 0.3%, that is 5 points. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, Candace Manriquez, and Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.